CliffCentral.com. It's time for us to meet our guest for the morning. I read his book over the course of the last few days, and his book is called Bending the Rules. His name is Rafiek Gangat. He was the first diplomat of color in South Africa's history, which is a fascinating moniker to have, because it's something that you don't even think was possible under the old regime. But that's right, he worked for foreign affairs under the NP, and then for the ANC government, straddled the transition. And he and I were just having a word about how history isn't this monolithic, matte-colored, very, very bland view. It's actually this intricately connected, interconnected tapestry where there are so many different strands of things all happening at once that it's very, very difficult to look at it in a myopic way. Certainly if you are bothered to go into the detail, and the detail is what makes the story so fascinating. So welcome, Rafiek. It's a pleasure to have you here.
No, thank you, Garrett. It's a pleasure to be with you. I mean, I've been a fan of yours for a long, long time.
Oh,
I
remember don't
when
lie.
Really? No, seriously, when you came on 702 the first time, I remember very clearly you did something, a Chinese version of an Elvis Presley song. You remember that? I thought that was really funny.
I think it was when Hong Kong became independent. Burning Rub.
Burning Rub. I really enjoyed that. I thought this is, it was like a freshness that came, you know, I'm an Thank old you. Radio guy myself, you know.
Yeah.
It was like this freshness that came into the scene. And I said, who's this Garrett Cliff guy? You know, he's cute. He's really good. And you've come a long way.
Well, listen, you've got the most fascinating history. I mean, you mentioned a bit of radio. You've the music business that playing cricket a little bit. You know, there's some fascinating stuff in all of this. But we've got to begin with the fact that, you know, I often sort of think it's a small achievement when you think about people who they say that this is the first black woman in space, or this is the first Chinese man to do X, Y, and Z. But in the case of South Africa's history, that's how we used to classify ourselves. So any man of color or woman of color who attained under the old regime any kind of distinction when they were purposely trying to stop those kinds of distinctions from being made, was a big deal. How the hell did you...
it's one of the stories in the book.
How did you end up working for Puk Buerta in foreign affairs when South Africa's whole policy to the world was only white people are going to represent this nation?
Yeah, it was very strange. I mean, it all started off, I was in Pretoria at the Leadership Institute, and I met this American academic, and we spent an evening together. And being who I am, I spoke isiZulu, I took him to a Shebeen, mm-hmm. I took him to a Roman Catholic seminary, and then we went to the Indian side of town through Voortrekker Hoogte, and then we came back to Sunnyside to my white girlfriend. And John was fascinated with this, you know, Rafiek.
He said, this is happening in apartheid
in South Africa. And he says, you know, you're just such a natural across all these things in your own country, you'd be a natural diplomat on the international stage. And I said, forget it. They don't want me, and I don't want to be with them.
Mm.
And that's when he convinced me. See, we South Africans are sold on this thing about, you know, there's a difference, separation between state and government, you know, and we don't see it like that. You know, he told me, listen, I'm a Democrat, and the Republicans would be in power, but I would serve my country as a diplomat. Because governments come and governments go, but the whole diplomatic field is for professionals. The civil service should be a professional core. And that's why we are suffering today. I mean, the problems we have today, I've come back to South Africa now to promote the book. And if I talk to everyone, and this is the problem we have. We try to build an independent group of people who served in any government that came, but the ANC just filled it up with their cadres, and what we have today, instead of meritocracy, we have, I call it ineptocracy, right? But okay, continuing with what you say, and then John and I sat down, we wrote a CV, and we sent it out, and obviously Foreign Affairs called me, And there were about 10 or 15 people, Afrikaners all there, and they wanted me to be this Uncle Tom. And I said, forget it. I was not ready, and they were not ready.
Did they tell you that straight up? They were like,
they wanted me to defend apartheid. And I said, forget it. And I walked away. And then I started a career on radio. And from radio, I was almost getting into television. And then they came back to me. But it was a period when they came back to me, change was taking place. People were not aware of it. You know, I mean, there's this movie now, The Endgame.
Yes.
And, you know, this was the 80s. The ANC was talking to the Afrikaners, and things were happening behind the scene. And I was aware of that, that all these things were happening behind the scenes, because I met some of these Afrikaners at the Leadership Institute myself. And then I sat with Foreign Affairs, and I said, okay, as a South African, as a person who loves my country, I'm not going to go out there and defend apartheid and all that stuff, but I know a process has started. And I'm going to go out there and explain this process and where this process is leading to. And that's how I came into Foreign Affairs. And it was a fascinating period, being the first person of color. Initially, I mean, everyone
looked at... You must have had funny looks from everybody.
Oh, yeah, funny looks. I mean, but after a while, because I spoke about biltong, about hunting, about rugby, you know, I became part of the scenery.
That's amazing. So did you sit down with Pick before you got the job? Or
no.
Did
no,
you only
no.
meet with other underlings?
Underlings. I met Pick later on.
And but when he first met you, did you go, what the hell are you doing here?
No, I mean, I met him on the first time I ever met him was under very strange circumstances. I had already served in Los Angeles, and I came back. And when I came back, you had, and this is one of the stories in the book, the first Gulf War broke out.
Yes.
And there were 300 and some South Africans stuck in Saudi Arabia. We had no diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia. We had never done an evacuation in the country's history. And to do an evacuation from a country in the middle of a war, I mean, it was like Mission Impossible. And all Pick says, do we have a Muslim diplomat? And they said, yes, there's one guy, he's just come back. And the next thing, I was sitting in Pick's office. And he says, I don't care what it takes, what it costs. Hale's ons mensa, you know, we must get them out.
So he was absolutely determined to bring these people back.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't realize that this was Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
And all the senior diplomats said, forget it. We've never done this before. I mean, this kid is going to go and do this.
How old were you at that time?
I must have been in my 30s.
Wow.
Right.
What a responsibility.
Yeah, and I came, but I had all, you know, I had lived in America, in Los Angeles for 4 years. So I was brash and full of myself, you know, this is about youth. You know, today he asked me to do the same thing, I'd have second thoughts. And then I went out and I did it and I pulled it off. And when I pulled it off and I came back and at the airport, I was so tired. I had been living on cigarettes and coffee and the media were all over me. And I said, the minister took a decision. I just executed it. If anyone has to take claim for him, it's him.
Mm-hmm.
He loved that.
Oh,
and the
I'm
next
sure.
thing, I was promoted to become spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Wow. And the rest is history.
Well, it is history. But again, as I said at the introduction to this discussion, there are so many people who view history as being black or white.
Black or white, exactly.
And they don't allow for any nuance. And it must have been fascinating because just as much as it might have struck some of the old conservative white people in the old NP government as strange that there was a man of color in the diplomatic corps, it must have similarly been a curiosity that got you to places that other people didn't get to. That they would have said, oh, you've got to have Rafiq there because X, Y, and Z, and he can add these things that we can't, and he can do things that we perhaps don't think of doing. Because in diversity, you do find these strengths. Now, even for someone like Pick, who history will say was, you know, not the most terrible minister in the old NP government, but who was someone who had a lot of character. He seems to have been widely loved and respected, despite the fact that he was there to represent a government very often who was widely reviled in the world.
Mm.
What sort of reception did you have when you introduced yourself to governments at that time as being a representative of this country?
Oh, it was fascinating. When I went to the United States of America, you know, Americans saw South Africa as black and white.
Yeah.
And suddenly there was this brown face.
Mm.
Now, where do you fit into the scheme of things? And on the one hand, there was this
and
interest.
A Muslim. They must have been confused by that, too.
And on the one hand, there was this interest. Now, where do you fit in the scheme of things? And I said, yes, I'm here to explain the complexity of the South African issue. The South African issue is not just black and white, and it gave me a platform. But on the other hand, I had my detractors who would say, oh, South Africa has sent an Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
Right? And I had to fight that as well.
Right. You had to constantly prove that you were actually your own agent.
Yeah. And then I had to, then I had within South Africa itself, amongst my own people, I had this thing about you being an Uncle Tom as well.
Yeah.
And I had to, I mean, fight this. In the end, I mean, for me, I justified this, and I think history has proven me right. The apartheid government built this house, this ugly house, with walls separating all the different people.
Mm.
And the anti-apartheid movement wanted this house brought down. As a South African, I was concerned about what happens if you bring the house down. What happens then? We have no roof over our heads. The trick was to bring the house, bring the walls, remove the walls without bringing the house down.
Mm-hmm. In other words, just keep the superstructure there so that you could build new walls and build a less unattractive house.
Yes. And that's exactly what happened after the first elections. The ANC won the elections,
mm-hmm.
but what Nelson Mandela went for was a government of national unity. Brought everyone together, didn't break anything, and let's build from what we have.
But let's not get right to 94 yet, because there are a lot mm-hmm. of stories before 94 that would be interesting to people. I mean, you were living through history here. A pivotal time in our history.
Exactly.
You were representing South Africa at the time that Nelson Mandela was released.
Exactly.
That the ANC was unbanned. You were serving diplomatic missions in the Middle East. Tell us about that time before 94.
No, before 94, yeah, okay, before 94, when I came back to South Africa, and then I became
a spokesperson,
it was a fascinating time. It was a time of CODESA, it was a time of the negotiations. South Africa was the biggest story in the world.
And people were calling you all the time from various 24/7. Missions to find out what was going on, because you would have been the person who relayed that information
exactly.
to the international community.
Exactly. And thank God we didn't have cell phones then. I had this pager, and this pager would go off in the middle of the night. It should be right next to my bed, and I would have to get up, and next thing I have to deal with the Boston Globe. And
they have a deadline. Were there also very important people who would call you directly?
Everyone would call me directly because I was the central point. Initially, there was a lot of resistance to this. What would happen was, like, for example, I'll give an actual example. Somebody would call me from the United States of America at this ungodly hour and wants to know about South Africa's position in Angola. And I don't know the details because, you know, I'm this generalist. So I'd have to call the person in charge of the Angola desk. And to call this Afrikaner guy in his home in Pretoria, he's sleeping at that time of the night or that time of the morning, and to get the details from him, and then I would frame the statement. He wouldn't even answer the phone.
Yeah.
And then I had to sit down with Puk and Neil van Eerden, who was my director general, and I said, I have a problem. And then they called all the top boys in, and then said, if Rafiq calls you guys any time, any place, you jump. Because I was... And then I got a lot of cooperation from everyone, and everyone then forgot about that Rafiq was not white, or he was not, you know, he's an Indian guy. He was just our spokesperson. He called you, you had to jump, give him the stuff, and I had to then react.
But you again bring up the fact that we didn't have cell phones at that stage. So they didn't answer their phone, but they didn't necessarily know it was you calling. Now suddenly they assume that it would be you calling, and they answer their
they
phone
had to answer
3
their
in the
phones,
morning.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no caller ID. They just have to
yeah, exactly,
guess, oh, hell,
yeah.
it's this Rafiq guy.
Yeah.
So from there on, I mean, you also then you take a certain amount of power and responsibility
exactly.
when you do this. And if you miscommunicate something, this is what people don't understand, especially in those days before cell phones and before the internet, when there weren't very fast and direct ways of communicating. You make a mistake, it can have extraordinarily bad consequences for all parties.
Extremely careful, yeah. What my superiors
word is put in the wrong place.
I mean, what my superiors always told me, if we see no comment, you're not doing your work. Right. You have to comment. But, I mean, it was a time where we didn't hide anything. It was a time of openness. I mean, the negotiations were taking place. It was a fascinating time. And the world wanted to know what was happening, and I would brief them on what was really happening. And it was really happening. There was no spin to anything there. it was really taking place. South Africans were sitting around a table. South Africans were negotiating a constitution. Mm-hmm. Things were coming into place. It was a really nice time to be.
And Rafiq, were you in the Union Buildings?
Union Buildings, and then I worked in Cape Town as well.
So when you're in the Union Buildings, and FW is then the president, he's obviously on the other side
of
the
building.
On the
other side, yes.
So what kind of an office do you have? I mean, Sia and I want to go to the Union Buildings and see all of this. I went there when Aziz Pahad was the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he showed me around. But, I mean, this is a very intimidating place to work. And you're working with, you know, there's the presidency just across the road. You've got this view of Pretoria. You've got all of these government departments in plain sight in front of you. And you are making really important moves with every step you take. And again, at this time of transition, it's even more significant because with the weight of history that's going to come afterwards and that came before, there's really no room for error. You say it's very open, but how much freedom did you have? How much oversight was exercised over you at that point?
Okay, I would always, I mean, when it came to a sensitive political issue, I would always go back to my principles. Yeah. To discuss it before I issued the statement. You know, it was that kind of thing. But on technical issues, general day-to-day mundane stuff, I had a lot of power and a lot of freedom. But you see, I have to go back to where I honed all my skills.
Mm.
Well, the 4 years I spent in the United States of America, I did most of the media work on the 12 West Coast states,
right,
including Alaska and Hawaii. And that was a lot of fun. And I was virtually on every radio station on the West Coast. I was on their TV stations, spoke to all the newspapers. So I really honed my skills there. And when I came back, I was ready for what I had to do. I think destiny played a role in this whole thing. And I was ready for it. I was the spokesperson who came with all these skills from the United States. And I was ready for the world. But, I mean, yes, it was difficult. But I enjoyed it. I mean, I thrived on the adrenaline, I thrived on the responsibility, and I really enjoyed it.
Did you help pack his boxes and get out of the Union Building?
No. But and I had some showdowns too, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I'll never forget the first time. I want to relate this story. I mean, we went to a BBC. I just come back and I was appointed, and I was this smart ass, you know, let's put it that way. And we went to a BBC interview. Now, I know in the United States of America, even till today, presidents do that. They do a briefing before they even, I mean, if it's a television interview, you actually do the interview itself.
Yes.
You know, you run through the whole thing and you prepare and then you go. But Book was Book. You know, he just...
No rehearsals.
No rehearsals, nothing. And while we were walking to the BBC studios, which was close to the Parliament buildings, and I started questioning him. And, like, he had this arrogant attitude, you know, who's this kid, you know, questioning me?
You were trying to run him through the
possible
snags. Exactly,
yeah, the possible.
Where they might try to trip him up.
Yeah. And it was a time when things were going smoothly in the country, but you had this third force and you had all these problems in KwaZulu-Natal. And Book went along and he spoke a lot of nonsense, but in between, he said something very significant. He said, we need to take away these traditional weapons, the spears and daggers and all that, from our hearts. And it was a nice soundbite.
Mm.
And we walked back and I said, you know, had we prepared, we would have really highlighted that soundbite, but with all this nonsense you spoke around the soundbite, you lost it. Right.
And what did he say to that?
Oh, I got a thong lashing. Nobody said that to Puk Botha, you know. I mean, you had this... You know, I mean, I hadn't been to the army. That was the difference. You know, as an African, all the Afrikaners had been to the army. They understood hierarchy and they understood, you know, how to
kiss. Very authoritarian.
Very authoritarian. I'd come from a rock music background.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a rebel. And I spoke my mind. And he was really upset. And I heard the story about he's seen more Christmases than me and who am I to tell him and, you know. But interestingly, after a few days, he told his private secretary to go and tell Rafiq that what he said was right.
Oh, really? So
yeah.
He had the humility to
see.
He
had the humility. And then thereafter, he took me very seriously. Thereafter, there would be times like, I mean, he was a strange character. I mean, I'm not supposed to talk about Puk Botha. You know, about
no,
Puk
I'm
Puk.
Interested. Go on.
No. He would be totally drunk at night.
Yes, sure. Everybody
sitting
knew
in his
this
office,
about it.
Sitting in his office, and I would get my beeper would go off, the minister wants to see you.
Uh-oh.
So I lived in Acacia Park in the Goodwood area, and I couldn't go with jeans like how I'm dressed. You know, I had to get up, have a shave, put on a suit tie, and then drive, you know, in this Cape Town weather at that time of the morning, get to his office, and he, why did I call you?
He couldn't remember why.
He couldn't remember why. So while you're here, let's have a chat. So I'm having this chat with this guy at like 2 o'clock in the morning. But those chats were really fascinating chats because it was a one-on-one, and he was very receptive. Like he would say, I see you hanging around with all the left-wing journalists.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I had this thing with all the left-wing journalists. What are they saying? And I would tell him straight out, they're saying this, and they're saying this, and they're saying that. And he would say, okay, what, you know, and we'd have this amazing, I mean, two-way discussion.
Did you and he ever carry on conversations after the change of 94?
Yes, I met him on a game farm, on a friend's game farm. Okay, the last I saw him officially was in Pakistan when we established diplomatic relations, and that's one of the stories in the book.
Mm.
And then I lost contact with him. But then I bumped into him years later after all the change had taken place. He had been Minister of Mineral and Energy, and he became an ANC member, and I met him on a game farm. And we had this fascinating exchange on this game farm. He remembered me very clearly, and he told all these Afrikaners around. I was the only Indian hunter amongst all these Afrikaners. And he told them all about me. And late at night, it was just one-on-one, the two of us on around this fire. I mean, great guy. I really enjoyed him.
Well, I would be fascinated to know what happened from 94 as well. And there are so many stories in the book that we'll probably only touch on a few of them today. But you had... Obviously, then the Minister of Foreign Affairs immediately after 94 was Alfred Nzo.
Nzo, yes.
Right. And his deputy was the current might-be presidential candidate, depending on how things go in the ANC, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, right?
No.
Wasn't?
No.
She was the Minister of Foreign Affairs after that.
She was Minister of Health. Alfred Nzo's deputy was Aziz Pahad.
Oh, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, quite right. So under those two things must have been very different.
Very different. You know, I mean, there's a story about...
And you were one of the few people who had experience from the previous regime who they decided to keep.
Yes. No, they kept a lot. I mean, this is what Nelson Mandela did, was he kept everyone. Kept everyone, although a lot of Afrikaners took the package and left.
Uh-huh.
But he kept everyone, and he tried to keep it all together. But that's where the problem started after Mandela went.
Mm-hmm.
After Mandela went, Thabo Mbeki then introduced all these cadre deployments.
Right.
And the cadres came along. And Nkosazana was very responsible for a lot of problems that we're having now as well, because she believed that all of us, all we did was we defended apartheid and we fought sanctions. And all that institutional knowledge and experience was replaced with cadres who had no knowledge or experience of foreign affairs and the workings of diplomacy.
And diplomacy, people don't really understand. I mean, you mentioned your media training in LA, for example, but people don't really understand what it means to be a career diplomat.
Exactly.
It's a very specialized profession. There are certain rules and things that you learn to do and say, and you attend many of these functions which look ceremonial and purposeless, but actually there's a dance to diplomacy.
Exactly.
Which requires a huge amount of finesse. And you can't have coarse, rough people in diplomacy, because they will cause trouble for you internationally, and they will ruin trade deals, and they will sour international relations, and they'll perhaps even cause diplomatic incidents.
We have plenty of experiences of that. You know, one of the first things, like when I became a diplomat in the old regime, it was 2 years of training. We went to diplomatic school, we trained in protocol, we trained in etiquette, and there are rules, because what happens in international diplomacy is people from different cultures come together.
Mm.
Like Indians eat with their hands,
yes.
Right? And suddenly, as an Indian, I would be sitting in with, let's say, a French person having dinner. And the French are very particular about the use of the cutlery, the way they have their soup. And you have to follow international protocol. I was at places where, I remember once, I'm not going to give a name, who is a senior person today in foreign affairs. And we were in Algeria. Mm-hmm. And the Algerians are very, I mean, influenced by the French and, you know, all of that stuff. And this guy took his soup bowl, he picked it up, and he just slurped his soup, you know, his soup from his soup bowl.
And the Algerians were horrified.
Horrified. And like, I wanted to hide my head under the table. You know, it was that kind of thing. But we had Jackie Celebi, who was the first black or African, Director General in Foreign Affairs. I mean, the first thing he said, we're going to Africanize diplomacy. So I don't care what glass you hold, in which hand, and what you drink in what. You know, there are rules. You know, you drink your whiskey in a certain glass, you drink your wine. He said, throw that all away.
Well, he threw away all kinds of rules. Later on, he threw away so many rules, he ended up in jail.
Exactly.
But this is such an interesting world to live in, because you get to meet the agents of change.
Yes.
You get to meet people like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. People in the Middle East, places like Saudi Arabia, which you mentioned earlier, which were so different then from what they are now.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia was an interesting experience. I mean, I went there first to do a rescue operation, and that's a whole chapter in the book.
Yes.
But later on, I was involved in opening the two offices, the embassy in Riyadh and the consulate general in Jeddah. I wouldn't like to live there, no ways. And it was interesting to open the place, and then they posted me off to Abu Dhabi. But before Saudi Arabia, I had this amazing experience in Pakistan as well. And, you know, it all really gelled. I mean, I played cricket. I was involved in the whole cricketing thing. And one of the first things that happened when I was in Pakistan was the South African cricket team came to play in Pakistan. And there was I as their consul general. And Hansi was there and Kepler was there. And their manager was a guy that I played cricket with. And I said, wow, this is, you know, times have really changed. And, yeah, so, I mean, going back to, and then I had this experience in.
But we didn't have diplomatic relations with Pakistan before then.
No, I was the first.
And same for Saudi Arabia. So how many other embassies and missions did you open up?
I opened up in Pakistan, and then I opened the two in Saudi Arabia. And then I was the first in Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
Now, Abu Dhabi and Dubai were not the cities that they are now.
No. When I went there recently to Dubai, and I was talking to somebody very senior in Dubai, and I was standing with him at a place, and I said, you know, when I was here, Dubai ended here, and from here you just saw desert, and today, you know, it's Manhattan from that point onwards. You know, Dubai was an interesting experience. We missed a lot of chances in Dubai. There was a lot of things South Africa could have done. There were opportunities for us, but it was. There was a lot of shambles in government. You know, we as diplomats, we would identify opportunities. We would then revert back to the state and say, okay, here's an opportunity. We need to do this. I'll give you a simple example, which is not really in the book. Dubai's success is they've taken the Ministry of Tourism and the Ministry of Economy and merged it into one.
Right.
And that's the root of Dubai's success. And I got to know the guy personally, and we became very good friends. And I remember when Alec Irwin came there, I said, Alec, what we need to do is let's get two guys from tourism, two guys from your department that come and work here. And then the guy agreed. He said, listen, you guys are not in competition with us. You guys are right down in the south, and I like you guys, and I like Mandela, so we'll train you.
Let's do some stuff.
Yeah, let's do some stuff, and we'll place the four guys for a year. And then see how Dubai does things, and then go back, adapt and adapt, and make it happen. And it didn't happen. And it was all talk at that stage.
Yeah, there must have been a lot of missed opportunities, and there must also be a lot of frustrations, because sometimes history takes a turn that you can't even predict.
Exactly.
As a diplomat. When you look at the Middle East, where you had quite a lot of interest at the time, And you look at the Middle East now. I mean, what are your feelings about what's been going on since you left active diplomatic work there, and what's been happening now?
Oh, I mean, the Middle East has moved on very fast. You know, and
because you spend quite a bit of time in Israel now.
Yeah, I mean, my last diplomatic posting was in Palestine.
Right.
And then I,
which is probably one of the most difficult diplomatic postings you can get, considering all the.
But what happened?
All the different factors involved.
Yeah. Now, what has happened? Well, what happened there is the story of my sequel to the first book, and which I sort of started off in this book, but it's really it's a fascinating story, where I finally took the two loves of my life, radio and diplomacy, and put it together. With Izzy Kirsch of Prime Media, a guy who's always bent the rules in this country, we met. It was a meeting of minds. We opened up a radio station with a studio in Palestine, Ramallah and a studio in Jerusalem. And we were using radio and music to bring the two people together. And it was an amazing experience. And what happened also there by chance, I was just the consultant on the whole thing because I knew people in Ramallah, especially in government, to get the whole project off the ground. And one morning, the morning guy was sick. And I put up my hands and I said, I'll do the show. And Izzy looked at me and he says, really? But you are an ambassador here. I said, bringing peace is far more important than my own ego. And I'm going to do it. And I did it. And he had an Australian consultant. And she heard the whole thing. And she says, I like that kid guy. Who's that guy? He was an ambassador. He can't be a morning talk show host. And the next thing, I became a morning talk show host. And it was,
how long did you do that for?
For more than a year.
Wow.
And it was so much of fun. I mean, you know, let me tell you what I did. I did the show from 9 to 12. From 9 to 10, just to ease people in, I had this program called the Classic 9 at 9. We'd play 9 songs with a link. And everyone had to listen in and find the link, and the first caller on the 9th song won a prize.
All right.
So both Palestinians and Israelis had, it was the common music, like we'd play 9 songs from Disney movies, and you had to find the link.
Not about checkpoints.
No. It was just music that both sides like.
All right. That's hard to do, to find music that both sides like.
No. They, when it came to English, we didn't play any Arabic music, any Hebrew music.
All right.
It was just English music. And both sides really liked the music. At our peak, we had huge listenerships. And then what happened was, from 10 to 12, that's when the real talk show started.
Yeah.
Unlike talk show hosts anywhere else in the world, I had to be very diplomatic. There were just two rules on my show. No hate speech and no incitement.
Right.
And I didn't take a position, and I played diplomat, and I facilitated dialogue. And I brought left-wingers, right-wingers, because in the end I believed, and I think, you know, this is taking the South African experience out there, that your enemy is a person whose story you've not heard. Let's share all the stories. We might find one another. And we were finding one, and in the end we got closed down. But that's a topic for my sequel to the first book.
I think there's still a lot of stories to tell. But you don't hold back in this book. You go into relationships across the color line, which at the time that you had them was almost illegal, right? It was completely illegal.
Completely.
So you had to keep those under wraps.
Exactly.
Tell Sia about him. Sia was born in 1999 or whatever. How old are you now, Sia?
1995. Can you give me some extra brownie points?
All right, so Sia was born post the whole change of 94. But, I mean, before that, it was illegal.
It was illegal, yes.
For an Indian man to be with a white woman.
But we found ways to do that. I mean, I had this white girlfriend. And I had this black woman who had this white boyfriend. And we would go out together. The cops came along. I'm with her and she's with them. right. And there were lots of ways to bent the rules. We hid. We did all kinds of stuff. And yes, eventually I did get caught out. And
how?
I was traveling on the N1. And the police pulled us off. And at that stage, the Afrikaner police believed that white women only went out with Indians because Indians supplied them dacha. No other reason. And they searched my car for dacha, and they couldn't find any dacha. So they took us off to John Foster's, and they beat the shit out of me, and they beat the shit out of Anne. And, I mean, that was it. But, even after that, I went to university. I mean, the law was still on the statute books. It's a fascinating story I have in my book that I went to a white university in the times of apartheid by virtue of a loophole in the law. I wanted to study isiZulu, which was not offered at my Indian university but was offered at a white university, and my lecturer was a black man. And I got the permission from the Minister of Police, and I was one of a handful of non-white, or let's say Indians, or non-white students at this white university, and a liberal English university. And I wasn't black, and I was kind of brown, and the English girls were kind of keen on me. You know, I mean, my youngest brother went to the same university after the change, and he didn't score as much as I did.
And what about this love of rock and roll? I mean, you talk about that quite a lot in the book, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've always had this love of rock and roll. And while I was at university, I mean, yeah, we started a student radio station at Natal University called NUTS, mm-hmm. Natal University Transmission Services. And I was part of the whole thing as well. And then I managed a rock band on campus, a white rock band, four white guys, one from Scotland, one from Dallas, and one from Joburg, and one from Benoni, and one from Durban.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, four guys, and I was the manager. And no white nightclub wanted to touch us because they just wanted bands that played, you know, the regular stuff, covers. So we went to the black areas. We went to Shebeens, and we went to all kinds of funny places to play. And we played, and these guys really did. I finally brought them to Johannesburg to the Battle of the Bands contest. And that's when the band broke up, because what then came into play was they had to go and do military service.
Yeah.
So the two guys then left the country. They left the country and the band broke up. And then I landed up working in the music business in Johannesburg. We had this place in Troy Street, Progressive Productions. One of the guys was the brother of Evoid, Carl Windrich.
Right.
Yeah, he had the Evoid group. And then there was Dirk Ackerman, and there was this group Flash Harry. He looked after them, and there was I forget the other name, and we became partners, and we started managing all kinds of groups in Johannesburg, and we used to do concerts. It was a fascinating time.
Do you see how, when I hear these stories, and I thought this reading the book too, how it really isn't just one or the other. Like, there are these, because a lot of people will want you to look at history as having been this way or that way only. And there couldn't possibly have been people who were, despite all the arduous difficulties of that time, who were straddling so many different cultures, so many different races, so many different backgrounds, so many different sets of values. It must be, if nothing else, your story has got to be, like, there's just so much color in this picture. It is not black and white.
Exactly. And that's why I became a diplomat.
Right. And it's fascinating. How do you, when you explain to people now, when they ask you what was it like under apartheid and what was it like post 94, do you have to go into quite a lengthy explanation, or can you give them a line that summarizes it from your point of view? Because I'd love to know how many people there are who have a similar point of view about how things are not just one or the other.
I know. I mean, today we live in the Twitter world.
Yes, you know, 140 characters.
I can't do it in 140 characters. No ways.
That's why you wrote the book.
Yeah. You know, like, I was saying somebody the other day, my mom's losing her hearing. And my mom always enjoyed stories. Mm-hmm. And she'll ask me a question, and I know halfway through the story, she's lost it. She can't hear me. And I said, Mom, I need to get you into Twitter, and I need to get a Twitter, you know, 140 characters. It's difficult. That's why I had to write the stories. Like, this whole thing started off with stories that could only have happened in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of weaved up, and it became like a memoir told in short stories. Like, for example, the one story I have about Audrey and what happened to Audrey in the book. How do you explain the Immorality Act and the Mixed Marriages Act? Now, here's somebody, I mean, my friend here. Who hasn't been through that. And this story is about Audrey was this black woman who had this white lover, and she had these two white kids. They didn't look like her at all, and they were her babies. And the police would break in the middle of the night and catch you in bed with all the forensic evidence and land you in prison. And the police broke in. Her lover was traveling, so they didn't catch them together. And then, what are you doing here? She says, I'm the maid. I look after these kids. And the kids walk down, mommy, mommy, mommy. And the Afrikaner police are shocked. They see a black woman
yes.
with these white, blonde, blue-eyed kids.
Mm.
And Audrey says, haven't you seen a black hen laying white eggs? You know, so in a funny way, it's sweet, it's funny, it's painful. I explain what happened with those laws. And all these stories have, they're funny, they're bitter, they're sweet, but it's painful as well.
But again, they're not even one-dimensional.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, here's a woman who, it probably broke her heart that she couldn't be seen publicly with her own children. It probably made the children's lives a misery in so many ways. But there's also joy and strength in overcoming these revolting laws and these immoral and now, with the benefit of hindsight, completely outrageous and offensive ideas of what humans should be doing with each other.
Exactly. I mean, you know what you're saying? I just read Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime.
Yes.
And, I want to contact Trevor and say, I lived the crime. You were born the crime. I lived it. You know, and I can understand what Trevor went through. You know, because I saw what used to happen with Audrey. Hmm. You know, there were times where Audrey didn't want to be seen in the public with her kids. I mean, and she would tell her kids in public, don't call me mommy.
Yeah. You know, well, for their own safety.
For their own safety. You know, so, yes, I mean, it was a difficult period. But in hindsight, we can take a lot of good from there and we can move ahead.
We haven't even scratched the surface. There are a lot of really good stories in this book, and I would suggest that anybody who is interested in that transitional period of our history and wants to hear a couple of really good tales about how things were, and you make it very human, because for a lot of us it's difficult to imagine institutional change mm-hmm. and the diplomatic world and the chaos of, you know, a post-Berlin Wall coming down and pre-apartheid falling world. It's a relic of our history now to some people. Right. This gives it a human aspect. And from that point of view, it was a pleasure to read, and it's a pleasure to see you.
No, it's a pleasure to meet you. You know what I mean?
Thank you for coming to talk to us this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The book is called Bending the Rules by Rafiq Gangat, and it is available in all good bookstores now. Grab a copy while you can. Right? You didn't write this for your health. Let's sell some of these books, for heaven's sake. Thank you so much for coming to be with us this morning. CliffCentral.com